From ABC News, I'm Bob Walker. The results of a nationwide referendum in the Soviet Union will not be known until sometime tomorrow. But the referendum itself may serve to worsen the already strained relations between the Kremlin and some of its more restive republics. ABC's Mark Bauman has a report from Moscow.
Soviet authorities are already accusing Baltic leaders of interfering with local balloting, and the Kremlin has threatened reprisals. The Baltic republics, Moldavia, Georgia, and Armenia have long said they would not participate in today's vote. But Kremlin leaders have organized some balloting in those areas, at army bases and in heavily Russian enclaves. Even in regions where the referendum will take place, it is brought to the fore old divisions. In the western Ukraine, for example, voters are expected to reaffirm greater Ukrainian sovereignty. But former Polish areas may also vote for their own independence. Mark Bauman, ABC News, Moscow.
Soviet President Gorbachev says a no vote on today's referendum, which is designed to keep the Soviet Union together, could bring chaos and even civil war. More after this.
Reaching for that dream that spells tomorrow. Well, another generation is a-coming on. I see a man. To educate her people, to live a better way. Hey, wouldn't you like to feel another shoulder at the wheel? If you help me join the line, you pull your weight, and I'll pull mine. Hey, you know, we share some wonderful dreams. Please help turn these dreams into realities. Please give to the United Negro College Fund. We want to give our best, please understand. We're not asking for a handout, just a hand. A mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz today asked that the economic embargo clamped on his country after it invaded Kuwait be lifted. We get a report from ABC's Sue Masterman in Nicosia, Cyprus.
Iraq's Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz has appealed to the United Nations to lift the economic embargo. According to the official Iraqi news agency, INA, he made that appeal to UN Undersecretary General Marty Atisari, who headed a 21-strong humanitarian mission to Baghdad. Aziz said that the extent of the destruction which the mission had seen during its week-long visit was a clear illustration of the facts of military operations against Iraq. He claimed that Iraq had fulfilled its obligations in accordance with UN resolutions and asked the UN to lift the siege. Sue Masterman, ABC News, Nicosia, Cyprus.
The UN Security Council is considering another resolution for Iraq to comply with. It reportedly calls for the public destruction of all chemical and biological weapons, the return to Kuwait of the thousands of citizens taken by retreating Iraqi troops, plus an agreement by Iraq to allow some of its oil income to be used to pay reparations for the destruction in Kuwait. Meanwhile, speaking of that destruction, a U.S. Army sergeant has plugged a burning Kuwaiti oil well with his bare hands. Sergeant Forrest Irvin, who's an Army engineer, turned a control wheel to shut down the burning well while braving tremendous heat and oil spewing all over him. He's all right. And after it was over, Irvin was asked if he could be a rival to the oil fire legend Red Adair.
Mr. Adair hasn't got his program set up over here, and this is a unique situation. They're going to be doing a great deal more and a lot more difficult jobs than we've done, so I don't think there's any comparison.
Outside oil experts, including those sent by Red Adair, the legendary Texan started flying in special equipment this weekend to fight those oil well fires in Kuwait. 2 months after the beginning of the war in the Gulf, Israel today allowed Palestinian workers from the occupied territories back into Tel Aviv and Haifa, the two main targets of Scud missile attacks. At the same time, a court in Tel Aviv imposed a sentence on 22-year-old Ami Pauper after convicting him of the murders of seven Gaza Palestinians last May. Pauper was sentenced to seven life terms in prison after he pled guilty. This is ABC News.
America, land of opportunity. Every year, over 1 million of our kids take the opportunity to drop out of school. And of those who do graduate, 58% can't add up a simple restaurant bill. Indeed, if we don't rise to the challenge now, we'll destroy our own businesses, our own industry, the very lifeblood of our nation. We can do anything if we put our minds to it. A public service of ABC's Project Literacy, U.S.
For the ABC Information Network, I'm Bob Walker.
From ABC News, World News, this week. I'm John Grimes, ABC News. Listen.
We simply have not come across or settled on one path, one single approach to try to solve this Palestine-Israel question.
The aggregate of $1 billion in civil damages and criminal restitution and fines is by far the largest single amount ever paid as a result of environmental violations.
And I mean, it's been one hell of a 24 hours.
In a moment, the people and stories that made this week's World News.
Hi, I'm Michael Bolton. Instead of carrying a tune, I'm carrying a message about abused children. Child abuse claims the lives of 3 American children every day. Parenting is a tough job. There are the pressures of caring for a child day in and day out, and the frustration of not always knowing what to do. The result? A sense of being isolated, cut off, feeling hopeless, which can drive a parent to strike out at a child. If you know of a parent having difficulty, reach out, sit down and talk. Give that parent a break from a stressful day by offering to take care of the children. And if you're having difficulty, get help for yourself. Talk to a friend. Sign up for a parenting class. For more information, write me, Michael Bolton, Box 2866, Chicago, Illinois, 60690. Take time out. Don't take it out on your child.
This message is sponsored by the National Committee for the Prevention of Child Abuse and the Ad Council.
With the fighting over in the Persian Gulf, the Bush administration has moved swiftly to explore diplomatic opportunities that might lead to a peaceful solution of the root cause of the problems in the Middle East, the relationship of Israel with its Arab neighbors, and with the Palestinians. Secretary of State James Baker spent most of the week talking with various leaders, issuing this statement after talks in Syria.
I think it's reasonably significant that you find the degree of agreement that exists here between the United States and Syria on approaching this issue, and between the United States and 8 Arab countries.
Despite agreeing to a continuing American military presence in the region, the Arab countries differ on how to make peace with Israel. After meeting with a Palestinian delegation and with Israeli leaders, Secretary Baker found neither side indicating any fundamental change in their long-held positions. Although Israeli spokesman Avi Posner said,
"We come out of the meeting between Prime Minister Shamir and Secretary Baker with a good and positive feeling that, maybe there is now a possibility to advance the peace process which we have been working at for so long."
Meantime, President Bush was exploring options with British Prime Minister John Major and with French President François Mitterrand, telling reporters after the meeting with Mitterrand,
"We simply have not come across or settled on one path, one single approach to try to solve this Palestine-Israel question."
Mr. Bush made it plain that he sees no role for the leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat.
Arafat aligned himself far more than he needed to protect his flanks with Saddam Hussein. He simply bet on the wrong horse.
But speaking through his interpreter, the French president was not so quick to dismiss Arafat.
"It's for the Palestinians to answer that. Mr. Yasser Arafat remains, to my knowledge, the leader of the PLO, and to my knowledge, the PLO still appears as the representative organization. There are doubtless other forces, too. I think they should make themselves known, but that's the situation as it is right now."
No one is really expecting peace to break out anytime soon, and you can look for a lot more diplomatic jockeying in the months ahead. Complicating the situation is the fighting inside Iraq between forces against and loyal to Saddam Hussein. As ABC's Bob Zelnick learned, Saddam's forces are using every piece of military hardware they can muster.
According to senior Pentagon officials, the U.S. now has firm proof that within the last couple of days, Iraq moved fixed-wing combat aircraft between bases inside Iraq in clear violation of the agreement reached at the end of hostilities.
Iraq's also said to be using helicopter gunships to put down the rebellion, which Saddam Hussein says he has done in the south of Iraq and soon will do in the north. Saddam made his claims in his first TV address since losing the war. He also promised political reforms, including a new parliament. As Iraq dealt with its internal problems, Kuwait observed a small step toward normalcy. with the USS LaSalle leading two merchant ships into the harbor of Mina Ashwaiba, Rear Admiral Rainer Taylor announced.
I think we can say it's official. A Kuwaiti port is once again open for business.
As the port reopened, the Emir of Kuwait returned home for the first time since he was forced into exile last August. ABC's Brian Rooney says the Emir will find a public less likely to go along with the old ways.
There's a greater mood in the public, particularly the people who stayed through the occupation, that they really want democracy. And there are divisions in this country, particularly between the people who stayed and the people who left. And I think between many of the Kuwaitis and some of the foreigners, many foreigners who live here. So it's a different set of politics that the Emir faces now than any Emir ever had to face before in Kuwait.
The homecomings continued in the U.S. as well. And among the troops arriving home, some 20 former POWs.
Lieutenant Colonel Clifford Ackery, United States Marine Corps. Chief Warrant Officer Ford,
Guy greeted
Hunter,
the former
United
prisoners
States
as their names were read out, and the Air Force
Lieutenant
doctor
Colonel
who
Jeffrey
flew in
D.
with them,
Bucks,
Colonel Wynne Mabry, told the crowd.
I'm very pleased to tell you that I think they're all medically progressing very well. It's amazing with some of the injuries that they've had how quickly they have begun to recuperate from both, I think, mentally and physically a very challenging experience.
Later, the former prisoners told of those experiences. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Fox detailed the treatment he got in Baghdad.
They just out of the blind hit me in the right ear, or right side of the head several times, punctured my eardrum, and then simultaneously they were hitting my right knee with what appeared to be what I thought was a solid rubber, kind of a billy club kind of thing.
For Air Force Major Jeffrey Tice, a different kind of torture.
I was subjected to a form of electrical shock therapy that I called the Talk Man. And basically, I had some wires wrapped around my ears and under my chin and was shocked periodically during early captivity when they were trying to coerce me into making a videotape.
Navy Lieutenant Jeffrey Zahn also was forced to tape a statement.
They took me to a TV studio, set me up next to the big guy that I was asking the questions. They told me what, I guess, five questions they were going to ask. Then they told me what my answers were going to be. And they asked the question.
Marine Captain Russell Sanborn recalled the watery sort of porridge he was given to eat and joked with his wife about it.
I kid my wife that I've been in training for Iraqi food for 3 years.
And speaking of family, that's how Captain Richard Storr kept his spirits up during his captivity.
What got me through there was thinking about my family, did a lot of praying, thinking about all the people back home, knowing all the support we had from the people in the United States and just the feeling that they were behind us 100%, knowing that they wouldn't let the war go too long, knowing that President Bush was going to get us home as soon as possible.
And when he got home, Marine Major Joseph Small couldn't believe the reception.
The welcome home at Andrews was probably the most heartwarming and emotional things I've ever experienced. The tremendous outpouring of support from the whole nation, it seems, was kind of congregated right there on the tarmac.
For other prisoners, theirs has not been as joyful a week. They are the ones still being held somewhere in Lebanon, hostages of various groups. ABC Susan Hack says their plight was brought up again during the week.
Secretary of State James Baker discussed the fate of Western hostages in Lebanon with Syrian President Hafez al-Assad, and the Syrian foreign minister said this week he would use maximum influence in Lebanon to work for their release. However, there are pockets of Lebanon that the Syrians just don't control, such as the southern suburbs of Beirut and the city of Baalbek in the eastern Bekaa Valley.
Among the hostages is former Beirut bureau chief of the Associated Press, Terry Anderson, who is starting his seventh year in captivity. Ending 16 years in prison this past week, the Birmingham Six. A crowd cheered as the Six, all natives of Northern Ireland, walked out of the Old Bailey Court in London after an appeals court overturned their convictions. They'd been sentenced to prison in 1975 for allegedly murdering 21 people in the bombings of two pubs in Birmingham, England. After repeated appeals, the court ruled that evidence used to convict them was questionable. Patrick Hill told the crowd.
The police told us for
from the start that they knew we hadn't done it. They told us they didn't care who done it. They told us that we were selected and that they were going to frame us just to keep the people in there happy. That's what it's all about.
Four of the six had confessed to the bombings, but had maintained they did so only after being beaten by English police. For the head of the police department in Los Angeles, a rough time from a local crowd. The demand for Chief Daryl Gates' resignation came during a public hearing, a little more than a week after white officers were videotaped beating a black motorist. The head of the Los Angeles Urban League, John Mack, charged that the incident was not an isolated one.
We are particularly outraged over what we are firmly convinced is a pattern, not an aberration.
A Los Angeles grand jury has indicted four officers in the incident, charging them with felony assault with a deadly weapon and using excessive force. The grand jury is considering charges against 11 other officers who stood by while the man was beaten. Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley says he is not asking Chief Gates to resign because of the incident. And Gates says,
I have no desire to stay here forever. I have certain things I want to get done. And one of the things I want to get done is bring calm and peace to this department.
As for the condition of the victim, ABC's Jane Platt tells us,
Rodney King is in good condition at a local hospital after undergoing surgery. The surgery was to work on some of the injuries he received as a result of the beating. King's doctor says he had suffered several fractures to his skull, and he may have suffered a heart attack as a result of a stun gun.
The incident has raised cries of outrage across the country, and Attorney General Dick Thornburgh has ordered a review of all complaints of police brutality the Justice Department has received over the past 6 years to see if patterns of brutality can be found among them. Some 15,000 cases are said to be involved in the review. Thornburgh's order came as President Bush sent Congress his anti-crime bill. It's basically the same measure he's been trying to have passed for the last couple of years. Mr. Bush says,
today, 2 years later, another 294 policemen and women are dead. 294. Almost three times the number of precious American lives lost during this entire Gulf War.
The president made his appeal as a new federal study showed that firearms are involved in one-fifth of the deaths of Americans between the ages of 15 and 34 and account for nearly half of the fatalities of young black men. Almost 2 years to the day after the Exxon Valdez spilled 11 million gallons of oil into the pristine waters of Prince William Sound in Alaska, the company and the federal and state governments reached a settlement. It was announced by Attorney General Thornburgh.
The aggregate of $1 billion in civil damages and criminal restitution and fines is by far the largest single amount ever paid as a result of environmental violations.
Alaska Governor Walter Hickel seems pleased.
It looks good and it feels good, and that's what's important. I think it's a good settlement for the state of Alaska. I think it's a good settlement for the federal government. In my opinion, it's a good settlement for Exxon. It's a good settlement for the environment.
An official of the Sierra Club, Mike Matz, wasn't so sure.
The amount of money could be enough, but we're not really sure until we have an opportunity to take a look at whatever studies have been done by the state and federal scientists to see what sort of damage has occurred.
The deal does not free Exxon from more than 300 lawsuits brought by natives of Alaska and others. In another action involving Exxon, the company has reportedly agreed to spend up to $15 million for a spill in New York Harbor 14 months ago. From the health of the environment to the health of the individual, a major federal study should be of interest to women who work with video display terminals.
Our study found that the VDT technology itself did not increase the risk of miscarriage. The women who use VDTs full-time at work had the same risk of miscarriage as the women who did not use VDTs at all during their pregnancy.
That's Dr. Teresa Schnur, who directed the study. Fears have been raised for the past decade about whether miscarriages can be caused by radiation from the terminals. There was also a promising development involving the detection of colon cancer. Scientists have discovered a gene that seems to be a link to an early stage of the disease.
We looked at DNA prepared from normal cells from an individual with cancer and compared the structure of this gene from their normal cells to the structure of the gene in DNA isolated from their cancerous cells. and we found that this gene was damaged in some cases.
Dr. Kenneth Kinsler, one of the researchers involved in the study. The isolation of the gene could offer doctors a means of detecting colon cancer at the earliest possible stage, when it is most easily cured. Colon cancer kills more people in the U.S. than any other type, except lung and breast cancers. The health of the nation's economy seems to be improving. One indication is wholesale prices. They dropped by 0.6% in February, thanks mainly to an 11% plunge in gasoline prices and an 8% drop in home heating costs. Economists are more interested in the so-called core rate of inflation, the amount left when volatile components such as energy costs are taken out of the mix. But even with a rise in that core rate last month, Erwin Kellner of Manufacturers Hanover is optimistic about the future.
Whenever you get an increase of 0.4% in the underlying rate of inflation, meaning in those products that are sensitive to the economy and are not affected by unusual developments like the weather or war, you have enough strength in the economy to take you out of recession.
Another positive figure was that for retail sales last month. They were up 0.8%, the first time retail sales have gone up in 4 months. The newspaper that once had the largest circulation in the country, the New York Daily News, is now owned by a British media mogul. Robert Maxwell bought the paper from the Tribune Company of Chicago following intense negotiations with the paper's nine unions, which have been on strike since late last October. Maxwell says part of the agreement involved reducing the workforce.
It means regrettably loss of jobs, but I am willing to go on record here that we will make a profit, barring any unforeseen circumstances, in the first year of operation.
The Daily News used to have 2,600 employees. 800 of them are being let go. There's a move on Capitol Hill to make us a nation of savers.
We're going to bring the IRA out of retirement. It's something that makes good sense for America. Americans understand it. They know it helps their economic future.
Lloyd Benson, the head of the Senate Finance Committee, has a lot of backing for a plan to restore a fully deductible individual retirement account to anyone who wants one. Right now, an IRA is not deductible if a worker makes too much or has a company pension plan. The new proposed super IRA has other features, as Senator William Roth explains.
One of the most significant features from my point of view is the ability this bill has to help our family meet educational costs, buy their first homes, and help with catastrophic health care.
The big unanswered question is how to cover the revenue lost to the Treasury by allowing more people to enjoy the tax deductibility of the new IRA. Best guess is by raising other taxes or by cutting spending. Louisiana's Democratic Governor Buddy Romer has been weighing his political career and thinks he'll make out better by changing parties.
The Republican Party is a team with strong, sound economic principles, emphasizing individual and collective opportunities. And that's a team I want to be on.
By switching, Romer hopes to stave off a challenge from the former Ku Klux Klan leader, David Duke, who's also running for governor as a Republican. The Republican nominee will likely face a popular former Democratic governor of Louisiana, Edwin Edwards, in the fall elections. Jerome Doc Pomus died this past week. He's one of those people whose names don't ring a bell, but whose work will. Doc Pomus was a songwriter.
This magic moment.
This magic moment, that was a hit for Jay and the Americans. He wrote Save the Last Dance for Me by the Drifters. Teenager in Love by Deanne and the Belmonts, Viva Las Vegas for Elvis Presley, as well as Little Sister, and many other songs for Elvis.
Brian Gray, a longtime friend. Doc Pomus was 65. He died of lung cancer. Complications resulting from AIDS took the life of another lyricist. Howard Ashman wrote and staged the off-Broadway hit Little Shop of Horrors and won an Oscar in 1989 for the song Under the Sea, which was featured in the Walt Disney movie The Little Mermaid. Howard Ashman was 40. And seven members of Reba McEntire's band were killed when their plane crashed in mountains near San Diego. The country singer was not on the plane. The month of March brings with it the annual Iditarod dog sled race in Alaska, and this year's 1,100-mile trek was won by Rick Swenson, who was asked how it felt to be the race's first five-time winner.
Two brands. brain dead to tell you. Man, I mean, it's been one hell of a 24 hours.
Swenson was referring to the blizzard which he got through, but which forced other drivers to take refuge, among them Susan Butcher, who had been leading and who would have won the race for the fifth time. March also brings spring training for the boys of summer. And among those trying to make a major league club was a boy of many summers ago, Hall of Fame pitcher Jim Palmer, at the age of 45, hoped to make a comeback with his old team, the Baltimore Orioles.
The fans have been just so terrific. You get all these letters, not one negative one. And for whatever their motives are, they apparently have been real supportive.
Father Time was not so supportive, though, and after being shelled in a game and pulling a hamstring, Jim Palmer went back into retirement. Identity crisis for the president. That story when World News This Week continues in a moment.
When you give blood, you give another birthday, another summer vacation, another concert, another date, another dance, another day at the beach, another night under the stars. When you give blood, you give another holiday with the family, another sunset after supper, another talk with a best friend, another laugh, another hug, another chance. This is Neil Patrick Harris for the American Red Cross. Please give blood.
A public service message from the Ad Council.
Seems as though hardly a day goes by but what you see President Bush on TV or his picture in the papers or magazines, but there's at least one person who just wasn't sure that the man next to him really was who he said he was. It happened as Mr. Bush was reading a story to some children at the Bancroft Elementary School in Arlington, Virginia.
Are you really the president?
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't you know that? What'd you think, I was a pretending guy? Did you? Did you really think that? Well, heck, how can I prove it to you?
The president fumbled through his pockets for a minute and came up with irrefutable proof.
Here's my driver's license. See what that says? B-U... S-H.
Bush. George.
George Herbert.
So you're the president.
Yeah, so I'll prove it with my driver's license.
The little boy still wasn't sure, though, so Mr. Bush made one last try.
That's all I got for Evan. God, how about, would you accept American Express card?
That seemed to turn the trick. And those are the people and stories that made World News This Week. World News This Week was written and produced by Gil Longin. Engineering by Carl Hoyon and Tien Trong. I'm John Grimes, ABC News, New York. World News This Week is a presentation of ABC News.